Romeo, India West. My name is Dick. At this time, we begin the technical event on Landmark. As I've heard so often, the major purpose of the technical event is education. Curious people who want to know more about how wireless equipment works go up nights, starting at 8 o'clock, and it usually runs until midnight. So during those 4 hours, they ask the questions. Most of the time, they get answers. People who are listening to this net quite often have got some very interesting past experience on almost any question that gets asked. Somebody will come along quite often with experience in that area saying, this is what I know, this is what worked for me. Your radio operators are extremely good at the empirical method of finding solutions, in other words, tinkering, you could call it. Amazed how advantageous tinkering as opposed to computer-aided engineering and computer modeling in some cases. Let me jump. One of the really big areas where lots of knowledge is more needed, subject of antennas and antenna design. Some radio operators in the process of tinkering with antennas in their backyard and really using them to communicate with each other, finding out what works and what doesn't work. There's an awful lot of antenna knowledge that comes from that particular method. Majority of the schools, from my point of view, extremely poor method of a poor job of teaching antenna engineering. Majority of electrical engineers walk out of school saying, I don't know what goes on with antennas, but it's so complicated, I don't understand it, I don't like it, I'm not going to work in that area. And that's, of course, the way it shouldn't be. The best transmitter in the world, the best receiver in the world, doesn't do much without a good transmitting antenna and without a good receiving antenna. So that's a sad state of affairs. Try to correct that. Antennas, transmission lines, transmitters that feed the transmission lines, the receivers that listen to the signal from those transmission lines, and the methods of getting good operation of that antenna radiating system is one of the very frequent subjects that are discussed on the technical net. Let me jump. We have a fairly loose schedule that we follow, sort of follow. During approximately the first hour, we take questions from those who do have a question or a comment for the net. Sign in giving us their call letters, their name, or yes, which means they do have a question or a comment. After that, approximately an hour, John KC2WGB goes to the mailbag. For those people who don't yet have a ham radio license or don't have the right equipment to talk to us directly over the air, they send him various kinds of communication. A number of those mailbag submittals, and we'll address those. John also monitors the EchoLink website, so if people have trouble getting an edge in WordWise because we don't leave the right amount of delay time between transmissions to reset the system, so a person in a far-off area trying to get it by EchoLink can't do it, by way of John monitoring the website, we know about that, and John also sometimes receives messages from people by way of EchoLink and the website, so we know when to go to somebody who has a question they weren't able to express by the normal means. So we got to John's mailbag operation, we then go to Paul, WS2N, who is very close ear to the ground as to what National Aeronautics and Space Administration and the other around the world. What are they doing? Paul keeps a really close eye on that, and he gives the benefit of that knowledge, and he tells us what's been going on in the last week. Along the way, Hal, K6DPZ, who's of emails of people who needed an answer on, it wasn't a set of TechNet subjects, by the way. Okay, if you've got a question or a comment for the TechNet, please give us your call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
K2RIY, Joe, yes.
We got Joe. You got Joe? Anyone else?
WS to Mount Paul with a space report. And be here, Dick.
Have a good evening. I'm sitting here listening.
I transmitted on the output by mistake. Very fine, Paul. And also I heard Barry into MB. Barry's going to have some words for us. So far with the real sign-ins, we've got Joe and Barry. Anyone else? Give me a call that is a name at this time.
Do Bernie, yes.
Okay, I heard Bernie. Bernie, you may have pressed the button on your microphone for a touch tone pad. So give me your call that is a Bernie.
Okay, I check. This is K Monkey's uncle, Bernie, yes.
Okay, we got K2 Monkey's uncle Bernie. And one more call. Anyone else with a check-in because they do have a question or a comment for the technical net tonight? Give me a call letters and name right now. Okay, we've got more than enough to get going. And Joe, let me think now. The last we knew, you were about to make some more measurements, and I think you did find a directional pattern, second harmonic, of those broadcast stations that you were monitoring last week. And one of the words I was looking for when you and I were talking to each other this week, trying to think of a word that's also used for product equipment that does service monitor. Another name for service monitor that I couldn't think of. All of a sudden I forgot it. Back to you, Joe. The B2LY1, K2LIW.
Okay, well, the question is not on that subject. The question is actually for Paul, WS2N. Paul, are you on radio?
Oh, yes, I am here, Joe.
Okay, Paul, did you get the item I left for you in your mailbox last Tuesday?
No, you were on the top of my list. You know, I go down a list. Thank you very much, Joe. I was going to say that. Whoever put that in my mailbox, I was going to say thank you. I'm sure you're out there listening, but I didn't know who it was. Very good. You know, I watched the whole thing, all recorded on NASA TV. What he's talking about is the STS 135, the final mission of Atlantis. Joe, thank you.
As long as you got it, that was the important thing. I tried it. I knocked on your door a few times. Door, so I figured, well, what the heck? I'm going to leave it at the rear of the mailbox. It should be safe. You got it. I'm happy for you. Because you love that kind of stuff.
Very well done. I thought it was great. Fantastic. Dick, over to you.
Sounds to me like you received a CD-ROM of that particular launch. Is that true, Joe? Go ahead. By the way, what I was trying to think of, the other word that's frequently used for service monitor is Lite Master. That happens to be the Invitsu product that does the equivalent process. The BYYY, K2LIW, the TechNet.
I have a call sign for you to add to the list, Dick.
Okay, give me that call sign.
DG.
Okay, Neil, Whiskey 2, November, David Golf. You will be going to him. So, Joe, any final words? I couldn't think of the word Sightmaster when I last saw you. Another alternate kind of electronics that does something similar to what a service monitor does. And I thought of it as soon as you and I left each other. The B2LYY, K2LIW.
I've used the Sightmaster before, and specifically I've used an S332B. I've used an S331C. I've used a couple other models also. They don't do everything a service monitor does, not my service monitor. Back to you.
And your favorite service monitor is what model number? Joe, go ahead.
Let's talk about service monitors. Well, I happen to have two IFR 1500s. I like them. They're very old, but they're very, very versatile. And they work like a champ.
all these good goodies in my mind, the Kenwood TS711A, the world's best frequency synthesizers, only got 30 memories, and doesn't have a digital signal processing, doesn't have some of the horns and whistles of modern day rigs, but puts out a very clean FM, very clean sideband, and a knob on the front panel that's very handy. When you turn that knob, you've got continuous control of the power output between 1 watt and 30 watts. You know, what makes that very handy is that if you're a microwave ham radio operator using the Mishley above 432, 1296, 2 gigs, 3 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, usually you get to those frequencies by way of a transverter. In other words, a chunk of electronics, drive it on some particular tunable IF frequency like 144 megs, and out comes 1296 or 10 gigs, so to speak. And so to have completely variable power output, which gives you the right amount of drive for the transverter, is a very handy function. So that's, to me, an oldie but goodie. The modern-day equivalent of a Kenwood TS711, a 2-meter all-mode base station rig, is probably a healthy $1,500, whereas that particular piece of equipment, probably invented around 1985, on the surplus market, you can buy one in very good shape for $300, buy a dented one even cheaper than that, and you're getting 90% of what you would with the $1,500 brand new one, from my point of view. So every piece of electronics I own is used. I bought very few things brand new, because I feel I have the ability to repair things I don't need brand new. Let me drop it.
Actually, I have a question for you, if you really want a real RF question, and this is kind of a strange one.
Fire away, Joe.
The other morning, I had the TV antenna pointed at 060 degrees, looking for stuff coming out of the northeast sector of, of interest, okay, like Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and so forth. Now, what I happened to notice, and this is very strange, well, it's not quite the back of the antenna, but it's close enough to it. I was getting RF-28, which is NBC, full scale, pretty much, but RF channels 30, 31, 30, 33, and so forth, 36, were like about half, somewhere more even viewable. Have you ever heard of a condition like that where one part of the UHF spectrum seems to be enhanced, where it or for some reason, comes in so incredibly strong where other frequencies are not enhanced?
I think I have, I'll admit it's rare. I have no good explanation as to why. By the way, another thing that you and I have been discussing, Joe and I are some of the very rare people. I saw in Suffolk County while watching over-the-air television and not specializing in old TV or satellite television. So over-the-air television, we've noticed that on a number of days, Channel 2, one that advertises itself in Channel 2, which I think is really channel RF Channel 33, there is no video there. And I was speculating that it's really co-channel interference that was causing my converter to say that there's nothing there. I noticed there's something weird about it, though. During these many hours of quite a few days in the last week, morning was one of them, in which Channel 2 video and audio is not there, and you think that your demodulator is not able to demodulate that signal. At the same period of time, I'm getting a beautiful electronic programming guide. And the electronic programming guide is being updated. So it's as if the channel was transmitting the electronic programming guide, but not transmitting the real audio and video. So next time you see no audio and video on Channel 2, take a look at whether or not the electronic programming guide is being updated. If it is, suggests that the digital demodulation is taking place, and that the signal that you and I care about was just not being transmitted, is my guess, Joe. W2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet.
Well, a couple of days ago, for a short period of time, I noticed that RF-28, RF-31, and 33 were not viewable, while other stations in New York were. Couldn't explain it, didn't have any idea what happened. Later on, half hour, 45 minutes later, or so, they just seem to come back. I did check the carrier level with my instrumentation, but, just kind of a strange thing. And, the other morning I snagged another RF station from Northern Massachusetts, an RF-18, so I got another new one for my list. Back to you.
subject of over-the-air television reception, which Joe and I do. 25 or 26,000 people that live in the community of Dix Hills, a section of Huntington, Long Island. I have reason to believe I am the only human being that town is watching over-the-air television. I'm the only one that has a rooftop antenna that's operational. That makes me a rare bird. And so, one of the things I wanted to mention about television reception, I forgot it. It'll come back to me in a minute, I think. I'll go over to Barry. Barry's the next guy on our list. Into Moondogs, who I believe is in the Carolinas right now, talking to us by Echolink or IRLP. So what's the latest with you, Barry? Into Moondogs, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Nothing really. I'm getting ready to leave the Carolinas. I'll be leaving tomorrow. Sad to say, because I had a lot of fun here, obviously, and I didn't want to leave. But I did have a comment about the signal. I think it's possible that they broadcast a separate sync signal. Not really a sync signal, but something that they use for the decoders to lock up on the UHF signal. You might not be getting that, why it would affect certain channels. And I'm just going to listen, K2RW and the group, and it's really a pleasure hearing you guys in 2MB.
Hey, you sound very good, Barry, and I can even hear some voices in the background. It shows you what kind of fidelity we're getting. I thought of the subject, Rich, that I wanted to mention, that you told me, and I think you're right. Desktop digital converters that Joe and I are using, I've got an interesting property to them. That is, you can tell it what channels you're in. You can manually program a particular channel and tell it what RF frequency it's on and what channel it advertises itself as. And that goes into memory. And so the propagation is such that that particular favorite channel of yours that maybe comes from Massachusetts is not there today. Go to that channel in our digital converter and listen to see if the propagation suddenly pops in. So this time, I'm being told that an awful lot of the modern-day television sets that you can buy, they automatically do a scan to find out if the channel is there. But you cannot go to a memory list of your favorite channels, per se. In other words, if at the time you do a scan, your particular favorite channel from Massachusetts is not coming through, you're unable to get your modern-day television set to remember that information so you can easily go back to it. I may be misinterpreting, but I think that's essentially what you were saying to me, Joe. W2RYY for a correction. K2RIW in the TechNet.
DPZ is here with quick answers.
Yeah, okay. I think the way the TV sets now are manufactured, they work like the old VCRs in their later days before they were discontinued. They have like a squelch circuit in the auto-tune for the tuner. When you have it do a search and do auto-tune, if it can't find a channel above a certain threshold, it just disregards it and ignores it. Like the converters we have, you sit on a channel and eventually if the signal comes in, you may pick up a picture, may pick it up broken up, but sometimes you get a hint as to where it is by reading the header information on the channel. At least mine does that, and I have to use the insignias. But the TV sets, all I tried a couple of different TV sets. I don't own them, but I've tried other people's houses that have a set of antennas, and they don't do that. If the signal isn't strong enough, it won't load it up into the TV's memory, and that's all, folks.
DBZ with quick answers.
Yeah, assuming that that's what it does, that would bother me. Because when I'm doing television DXing, I want to go to particular channels and see if they're there. So how do you get around that problem, Hal? Say 60 PN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I gotta run in, grab a coffee, I'll be right back. I just want to let you know I'm here for the quickie answers, and I wasn't paying too much attention to what you were talking about, subcarrier TV. But I'll be here, I've just got to get some coffee. I'll pick it up, Dick, and hello to Barry. I'm surprised I heard him.
Yeah, earlier during my sign-in, I mentioned that K60PZ will be standing by for answers. So you were already signed in earlier. You didn't have to sign in again. All right, the next person on our list is Bernie, K2 Mike Uniform. And Bernie, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2RW and Tech.
SWR makes such a big difference on transmit, not nearly such a big difference on receive. Now, I know it does make a big difference on receive, but you're a lot more critical on transmitting. Curious how that phenomenon works. Secondary thing is, somebody has information on a list of satellites that work, 2 meter 440. I want to that, so I could try that. Maybe question about one of the ones is. Back to you, Dick. K2MU.
Do you have a quick answer on the SWR thing?
Okay, go right ahead, Al.
SWR is more critical on transmit because these newer transceivers sample SWR to protection of the output stage, and if you have a standing wave ratio of above 2 to 1, the power of the transceiver will start cutting back. So this is why you want to try and maintain a low SWR on a solid state type of transmitter. If a tube transmitter, it won't be that critical because if you dip the plate, tune the load, on HF transmitter, you're still forced to signal out. But on the newer equipment, if you have an SWR, your power will throttle back. And the other question, I got to get coffee. Go ahead, Dick, pick it up. K6DPC in the tech fair.
Comment?
Go ahead, John.
What Hal is saying is very true, but also on receive mode, we have an automatic gain control in the ALC sort of compensate for that. So it opens up, the gate goes wide open on the receive. Have that ability to do that. Back to you, Dick. KC2.
KC2YDT with a comment on the secondary.
Okay, good. We'll be to you in a minute, Matt. Whenever the antenna, or whatever is on the far end of the transmission line, doesn't present a pure 50 ohm resistive load, assuming we're using 50 ohm cable, and some calculatable amount of power extending down that line goes to that mismatched load, calculatable amount of it gets reflected, it comes back down the transmitter, the transmission line back to the transmitter. That additional power coming back to the transmitter can give it quite a bit of grief, create overheating the final stage, knock it out of resonance, and do some pretty nasty things. Old days of tube transmitters where the antenna tuner was built in, so to speak. We had a tuning and loading control. Most of our rigs, like a DX100, for instance, could probably tolerate most angles of a almost 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, and you readjust the tuning and loading control, and everything becomes hunky-dory, and the tube now sees the exact impedance it wants to see. All of a sudden, we want compact rigs with no tune. Good news is no tune means that you don't have to worry about the tuning and loading control. Bad news is that you've either got to buy a rig that's got a built-in automatic tuner or buy an external unit that's called antenna tuner. We drop. And now I've got to use that tuner to reestablish the correct impedance. These no-tune rigs, these are now more compact rigs, anything more than about a 1.5 to 1 standing wave ratio, they start giving you some grief. So reflected power is the grief to a transmitter. In the case of a receiver, there's multiple ways of looking at this. You could say that a receiver is extremely forgiving, nowhere near as persnickety about what standing wave ratio it sees. One of the most interesting experiments you can do with any one of the HF rigs you own, say for instance you want to listen to the 40 meter band, and take a random piece of wire a few feet long, skin the wire, and plug it into the center conductor of the output connector of that transceiver. In the receive mode, that thoroughly non-resonant, very short piece of wire will give you reasonable reception. You hear the guys at 40 meters. You will notice that the S meter doesn't go as far up as with a real tuned antenna. The fact of the very poor resonance phenomenon, the very poor impedance match of that random piece of wire, maybe it knocks down the signal strength by 15 decibels. That's what, almost 3 S units. However, because the noise of the atmosphere on, say, 40 meters, most of the time, is so loud that when the poorly matched antenna into your receiver cuts down the signal by 15 decibels, automatic gain control of the receiver cranks itself up by 15 decibels, so that your poor antenna is losing 15 dB of signal and losing 15 dB of noise that's on the band. Therefore, the signal-to-noise ratio stays almost the same. So you could say the receiver is very forgiving. You could say the does all the adjusting for you. Let me drop. And it's really because on most HF frequencies, most of the time you'll notice that your S meter moves even when there's no signal, just the automatic noise of the band itself. The 80 and 40 meter band usually has an amount of noise of the atmosphere and the ionosphere, base, whatever, man-made noise. There's all kinds of sources of noise down there. In any case, it's the equivalent of a 30 decibel noise figure. In other words, the noise coming in is 30 dB louder than the noise you would have coming from a 50 ohm resistor that's perfectly impedance matched into a very low noise receiver. This 30 dB noise figure is quite often possible on those frequencies. Go up to the 2 meter band or the 440 band, where the outer noise of the band is a hell of a lot smaller. On the 440 band, the noise of the atmosphere is probably equivalent to a 1 or 2 dB noise figure. And now you use that small random piece of wire on a 2 meter receiver, and you will suffer. In other words, you'll get a very weak signal. There's no noise that can be rejected, so to speak, by the receiver. Now it's pure signal reception, not signal-to-noise ratio. So you can't get away with that on VHF, UHF frequencies. But on HF frequencies, boy, you can get away with murder. You can use any old chunk of wire as a receiver, and 95% of the time, the receiver works like a charm, and you hear everything is there to be heard. Let's see what Matt's got to say on this. Mr. YDT, K2LAW, go ahead, Matt.
Steve PZ is back, and I have a comment about SWR there.
Okay, Matt first, and then Hal in that order. Go ahead, Matt.
Okay, this is in response to his secondary question. I would say SO50 is the easier 2 meter ballet to work. Steve, you can find that on www.mat.org.
Let me have a couple more words on that one, Matt. If he goes to AMSAT.org, www.AMSAT.org, and does a search for SO50, I think you're telling me it's going to tell you a lot of information about the satellite, uplink frequencies, downlink frequencies, modes of operation, how much antenna gain is required, how much transmitter power is required, what kind of receiver noise figure is required, how much aiming of the antenna is required. As you can tell, I'm asking a bunch of questions. I'd like the answer to be that AMSAT at that website is going to give me most of that information, or at least give me references where I can go and find that information. Is that about the way you see it, Matt? KC2YDT, K2LAW, the TechNet.
Okay, well, on AMSAT,
length of cable. Take these cables. decibels, one at a time, and put them in series with your feed line going to the radio. Now, at some point, you're going to find a length of cable that's going to be called the sweet spot. And when you hit the sweet spot, even though it's a standing wave, it latches into your radio, and you'll get the power out. K2RIW, keep 6 dirty purple zombies, and I'm sure Dick has comments about that one.
Yes, I do. What's really happening when you change the length of coax cable to an antenna, that's a less than perfect antenna. If, for instance, you had an antenna with a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, you're plotting all possible impedances that give you a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio by taking your piece of Smith chart, put your shot point in the center of the Smith chart, put the pencil on the number 2 of the the 3 o'clock position of the Smith chart, there's a line labeled number 2, and doing a circle of that diameter. That's the 2-to-1 standing wave circle. And as you change lengths of transmission line, your instantaneous impedance is a dot that's on some portion of that circle you have just drawn. So as you change that length of cable, you're walking along that particular circle of all possible impedance combinations that give you 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. Because of the peculiarity of the way the final stage of a transmitter behaves, any transmitter will be happy on some particular portion of that circle and unhappy at some other portion, and therefore you'll produce more power output and less sensitivity for it to be cutting back. So it's partially the design of the transmitter, the way the final stage was lined up, and whatever. So I'm going to agree with Hal on this one, and it's an interesting experiment to do. The brute force, let me drop. I have an antenna that's less than ideal. It's got a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio. The brute force approach would be to make corrective action right at the antenna. And if you write articles, for instance, there's an article by K2RIW that's on each of the two websites, Mike 1 and Mike 2 website. Mike 1 is www.amateurradio.tangovictor. And Mike number 2 is limarktechnet.org. .com, I think it's .org. Anyhow, you'll find an article by K2RIW about getting an ideal impedance match of a dipole and or the driven element of a Yagi antenna. So if it's a Yagi antenna you're using, for instance, by following the advice of that article, relatively simple tuning procedure would allow you to correct your antenna and make the standing wave ratio as close to 1-to-1 as you like. So correcting the antenna itself is not difficult. But another approach is a random length of transmission line. Each has its advantages. I mean, if the antenna is already installed at the top of the tower and you don't want to go there, then the change in length of transmission line is a beautiful way to go. You probably have questions on all of the above, Bernie, and that's the time to ask him. K2 Mike Uniform, the voice of Bayville, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mike. Correction, Bernie.
K2FU here. Yeah, that's great. I loved all the listening, sitting back listening to everything that it's to say. And thank you for the tip on the satellite. That's O50. And yeah, Dick, it was mostly what you were saying. On the HF, like you said, a few feet of wire, and you fell. I don't know, just a phenomenon. You know, something. Everybody who's done HF long enough knows that. Away with the highest WR for transmitting, but anything for receiving. Most of it. Really enjoyed the commentary, as always. I'm sitting out here in the sunset, and this is just the perfect way to see you. This is K2YDT,
one more additional comment about this week.
Go right ahead, Matt. KC2YDT, K2RIW. Bring us up to speed on satellites.
Okay, there's also a great app if you have an iPhone or Android.
AMSAT satellites, one of the more rare birds that's going in that direction. So check in with us periodically, ask more questions, and let us know how that project of yours goes, what antenna you've selected, what transmitter you've selected, what satellite you've selected, and so on. So come back periodically and give us an update on that. When it comes to tape measure Yagis, there was a beautiful article that was in the Rah-Rah Journal. Rah-Rah stands for Rochester Amateur Radio Association. So the Rochester Amateurs, approximately a year ago, had a beautiful article on how to start off with tape measure steel tape, cut it just right and lay it on top of a PVC pipe acting as the boom. And when you set it up just right, you can make this extremely high performance 3 or 4 element 2 meter Yagi, and you can probably build a 450 version of it. What's nice about that Yagi is that if you happen to be doing where you're running through the woods doing direction finding with this thing, as a branch of a tree hits the elements, it doesn't damage the elements, they just fold, or you can easily fold those elements to put it in a very compact manner inside of the trunk or a small box or whatever in your car. So a Yagi that has elements that can be folded and they automatically pop out, the high performance, is a very handy thing to home brew. And Bob, I'm trying to think of, one of our directors, I guess he's not a director right now, maybe he was a director last year. I did give him a website to go to a repeater.
Bye, Bob.
It was W2OSR. Bob was about to build some of those Yagis about a year ago, and I gave him that email address by which he could get a copy of that article. It's a very nicely done article, so that'll give you a lead. If you want to homebrew Yagis, the best articles I know of for homebrewing 2 meter and 440 Yagis is the one that was in the Rochester Amateur Radio Association, the Rah-Rah Journal, about a year ago. And as I said, W2OSR had a copy of that supplied by me, and I could find it again. So that's a very good article about homebrewing Yagis. And another good article about homebrewing Yagis of the so-called coat hanger type antennas is by going to the website of Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo, WA5EJB, Whiskey Alpha 5 Victor Juliet Bravo.com. That's Kent Britton in the Dallas area of Texas. He's had some very nice articles in there. He sells these, let me drop it. He sells printed circuit Yagi-like antennas, other kinds of antennas. And a little bit of searching at his website, you'll find his third or fourth page of his website in which he shows you how to build very high performance, very low cost Yagis for these bands using things like coat hanger wire. And at first you would think because you use inexpensive components to build a Yagi, you would think you're going to get low performance. Absolutely not. As long as you know what you're doing, you can use the right components, you can build the performance out of a slightly homely looking antenna, so to speak, that's not quite as pretty as the commercial product, but you can build it for $5 instead of buying it for $130, if you know what I mean. So, good place to go if you want to do homebrewing antennas. And we amateurs, it's one place where we really shine. Homebrewing antennas, tinkering them with them, and finding ways of making them work better. And as you build an antenna in your own backyard, let me drop. And you're using it to receive a signal. At the same time, you're putting your hand near the tip of an element. And the tip of an element with your hand nearby has extra capacitance that tells you that the gain goes up or down. Does the pattern change to actually touch an antenna while it's receiving? And if you're using very low amount of power, even to touch it while it's transmitting at a very low power level, hands-on experience, which gives you a lot of knowledge about what really takes place inside of an antenna. So keep that in mind. Next person on our list was Neil, Whiskey 2 November Delta Golf. Go right ahead, Neil, K2RIW the Tech Man. My name is Dick.
DPZ with a fast comment on the antennas.
Go ahead, Hal.
And what you could do also is take a long, thin screwdriver and just run it along the element, and you can see the change in the characteristic, and then you can see if the element is maybe too long or too short for its resonant point.
Okay. Yes, with a piece of metal, shifts the resonant frequency, holding a piece of copper tape on the end of a wooden skewer near the antenna tip. Its capacitance lowers it to a lower frequency. A medium-sized piece of copper tape on the end of a wooden stick held near the center of a parasitic element cancels some of the magnetic field in the center and tunes it to a higher frequency. So, holding a large piece of copper tape near the center of an element tunes it to a higher frequency. Putting almost any kind of metallic object near the tip adds capacitance and goes to a lower frequency. So, you can have a lot of fun doing your own tuning of a Yagi and without even going over there with scissors to make an element shorter and then replacing it with a larger one, you know, and doing a destructive process. By this tuning procedure that Hal and I are describing to you, you can get a lot of information of watching signal strength, even the transmit mode or the receive mode, doesn't matter, while doing those tuning procedures. It teaches you an awful lot about what really goes on in some of the Maybe with any further questions or comments on this one, before I go over to Neil, give me a call, let us right now. K2LIW Protect Net.
More comments on the antenna.
Yeah, go ahead, Hal. And be careful about transmitting too loud, Hal. You're jumping out of the machine periodically.
What is called a tuning wand. Take a brass screw on one side of a piece of wood, you know, long piece of wood. Take a piece of powdered iron from a slug tube coil on the other side. Bring it near the driven element, and that's going to change the resonance of the element. The brass will make the element resonate higher. The powdered iron near it will make it resonate lower. And it's a very easy way of checking if you have a sweet spot on the element. Go ahead, Dirk.
Thank you, Hal. Now I'm going to go over to Neil, Whiskey 2, November, Delta, Gulf, who lives in that crazy town called Huntington. I don't know anybody that would live in Huntington. I happen to live in Huntington. Go right ahead, Neil. K2RHW in the tech net.
All right, Dick. I apologize for the echo link tonight, but I've got a lot of schoolwork. I'm going to take a break and ask you this silly question, but let me drop and find out if my audio is okay.
You sound beautiful, Hal. As good as any other guy in Huntington. Please proceed.
Alright, I think I kind of warned you a long time ago that I had come up with a silly question and I had since forgotten about it. But this came to mind last 4th of July, and I remembered it again this 4th of July. So when we're watching the fireworks, and we see them all going off, every now and then you'll see one that breaks up into much smaller pieces that resemble electrical sparks. Now, I know they're not electrical sparks. That's what we think of them. The sound that they make almost sounds like static and little sparks detonating. So this question came to me. Let me drop. So when fireworks detonate, get light energy, get heat and infrared, and there's kinetic energy from the blast which creates sound that we hear. So my question is, in its most minuscule part, is there any RF energy generated during that type of gunpowder blast, even if it's minuscule? That was my question, that's all. Back to you.
That's not a dumb question. That's a very very deep question, believe it or not, Neil. And now you're into the field of radiometry. Radiometry, in other words, what does a radio telescope see? And how sensitive can it be? What are you looking for? Any substance that is radioabsorptive at that frequency, capable of making an awful lot of radio noise, is nothing but heat the object. If I took a so-called black body radiation object, in other words, I take a chunk of carbon, and take my word for it, if you have a big enough chunk of carbon and you aim a radio signal at it, carbon is a resistive, volumetric material, it'll absorb your RF energy, just like a 50 ohm resistor, just like a carbon resistor, you know, an Allen Bradley resistor, if you took it apart and looked inside, take your RF energy, current flows through the carbon, it takes your RF energy and turns it and makes it. So, a carbon material, heat it up. Tell me, how many degrees Kelvin is your carbon material, and how sensitive is the antenna that's looking at it, and I can predict for you with a pretty good accuracy exactly how much radio noise you're going to get in microvolts or minus dBm or whatever. That is called radiometry, but there's a catch. Let me drop. Radiometry only exists for materials that are absorptive at that frequency. Material was thoroughly transparent at that frequency. Geometry almost doesn't work. Now, there's a relative function going on here. When I say absorptive versus transparent, turns out nothing in the world other than a vacuum is 100% transparent. But there are some things that are so darn transparent that when you heat them up, they do not make measurable radio noise. Very similar to if you're looking at a storefront window, a piece of glass, and you're looking at it at right angles to the glass from your point of view is almost 98% transparent. It appears to be. Yep. Heated up that glass. As it was at, let me pick a number, 500 degrees Fahrenheit. It would burn your hand and you touched it. But you're looking through that glass, absolutely no difference. Your radio measurement, if you were, if the piece of glass was being held in front of your antenna, and you first listen to a radio signal without the glass, then put the piece of glass there, then heat up the glass to 500 degrees or 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and you measure the difference in the radio signal going through the glass, there would be almost no difference. Transparent. The other way around. Take a sheet of carbon material of some kind, put it in front of your antenna, you're going to get a predictable amount of insertion loss of the signal you're listening to. As you now heat up that carbon, because it is a absorptive material, truly anything that can absorb will also emit. So you heat up that carbon to, let me pick a number, 500 or 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, you will be able to measure the increase in noise power coming into your receiver because that non-transparent material is now at some significant temperature above absolute zero. Everything above absolute zero is a radio signal. I'm going to give another example of this. When I was viewing, if you take a look at the August issue 1972 QST magazine, you'll see a picture of K2RIW standing in front of a 12-foot parabolic dish antenna. And through an issue of 1972, there's an article entitled Houston is Hollow, in which I used that antenna to listen to the 1,000 megacycle signal coming from the Apollo 15 and Apollo 16 astronauts while they're on the way to the moon, while they're orbit around the moon, while they're on the lunar module, while they're on the lunar rover. I was listening to their S-band signals with that antenna. However, in order to tune the antenna, I had to have a very strong signal far away in order to tune the antenna, and I aimed it at the sun in order to do sun noise measurements, in order to tune the antenna. However, while I was doing that procedure, I recognized the fact that when I stood on a wooden chair in front of that antenna, and I reached my hands up to the feed horn in front of the antenna in order to move the feed horn, I noticed that the radiometry receiver, the needle, in other words, because my body is running at roughly 300 degrees Kelvin, and I'm an absorptive material at 2.3 gigahertz, I was emitting radio noise. I'm in front of this dish, the dish is picking up the noise, the radio receiver was measuring the 2.3 gigahertz radio noise coming off my body, because I'm a hell of a lot hotter than the blue sky the antenna was aimed at. The antenna was aimed at about a 30 degree angle up in blue sky. It's a 3-degree beam with antenna. The blue sky is very cold. When I stood on a wooden chair in front of the dish, I could measure the noise power coming out of my body. The next step, let me drop it. The next step is I would run an experiment where I would aim this antenna through a sheetrock wall, which is reasonably transparent at 2.3 gigahertz. And if there was a human being on the other side of that wall, I could read the radio noise of that human being and know that they were there. And if they moved out from behind that wall, I would see the radio noise get quieter. That is radiometry, a real good radiometry type of receiver. Broadband IF strip, a very sensitive detector, and it can measure numbers like 1 degree Kelvin change. A real good radio telescope can do that. And so, therefore, when it comes to the fireworks you were looking at, the first question now is what frequency you're using. And I used ordinary frequencies, 40 meters, 10 meters, 6 meters, 2 meters. That smoke and flame and everything else coming out of the fireworks is transparent at those frequencies. Even though it's hot, very little noise would be registered because it's transparent. If I now went up to the 10 gigahertz band, where 10 gigs aimed at that fireworks would see excess noise. As you go down in frequency, you're going to see less and less of it. As you go up in frequency, 10 and 24 gigahertz, those particular ham bands, it is my belief that a sensitive enough receiver will see the radio noise coming out of that material. That would be a darn interesting experiment to do, Neil. W2NDG K2RIW. Darn interesting question.
Well, thanks, Dave. Like I said, that one's been floating around in my mind for a while. Like I said, the thing that sparked me to think of that was the, you know, sparking style fireworks, which aren't actually sparks, as I mentioned. All right. I can see where you're coming from. And thanks a lot. I'm going to get back to writing my paper here, and I'll be listening. W2NDG, back to you, Dave.
Sound like you're a teacher or you're taking a course. Are we allowed to know what the subject of the paper is? Just because I'm curious, Neil, go ahead.
Writing a paper recommending the process for creating a fictitious, a human resource information system for a fictitious corporation. I'm taking Fundamentals of Business Systems Development, University of Phoenix, as part of my someday bachelor degree here. And that's about it. So Sunday nights and Monday nights are usually kind of crazy for me.
Fantastic. Good luck with that project, Neil. And check in with us more often. There was another subject I was going to mention along these. It'll come to me in a minute.
Authentic.
Go right ahead, John. And you're next here on the line. KC2WGB, K2RIW, the tech man.
Yes, I believe you're right that there has been measurements of volcanoes. I don't know if they're measuring bone or the actual flame, but there is our about the upset.
In the case of the emissions from the volcano, which consists of a whole lot of highly heated plasma-like material, and the nice thing about a plasma, there's a plasma, you make a solid material, you heat it up enough, it turns into a liquid most of the time. Heat up a liquid enough, it turns into a gas. Heat up a gas enough, many things will turn into a plasma. That really means that the electrons and the nucleus of the atoms will separate from each other, and now you've got these ionized materials. You've got a conducting medium, ionized path it is. And so hot ionized material is at almost all frequencies, radio absorptive, radio emitter, on. So at many radio frequencies, I predict that the smoke and flame and plume and everything else coming out of a volcano will give you a measurable amount of radio noise. So to make those kind of measurements could be a lot of fun. I do remember, a whole lot of years ago when I was at the, called it now, the Rocket Laboratory of Edwards Air Force Base, they were aiming radio signals through the exhaust plume of rocket engines in order to measure the characteristic of that flame. There's all kinds of good information they could get out of it. Part of what they were doing is to try to come up with chemistry for rocket engines that would not give a measurable signal that can easily be found by a heat-seeking missile. So they wanted to look at the signature of the radio noise that was coming out of the plume of a rocket engine. Let me drop it. Well, anything that is radio absorptive can become a radio emitter if you simply make it hot enough. But when it comes to radio emitting, one of the things that's kind of hard to believe, that almost all the antennas we have ever used, microwave, HF, whatever, that antenna is transmitting a signal. Hard to believe. For practical purposes, not a single electron leaves that antenna. You would think those electrons are being transmitted into space. The answer is absolutely not. Jumping back and forth within that antenna, with that resonant RF energy that you're pouring into the antenna, and all kinds of current is flowing, and the current in turn makes a very strong, predictable, cyclic magnetic field, and the magnetic field is what appears to be doing the majority of the radio frequency reading. Magnetic field is what comes off your antenna, not a single electron. And that suddenly became clear to me when I was listening to the Apollo astronauts on the moon, Apollo 15 and 16, on the moon, a quarter of a million miles away, 240,000 miles away, and nothing between the moon and the Earth is there except the hardest vacuum in the world. So it's hard to imagine electrons of an antenna signal, antenna radiated signal, going across.
hit nothing but a magnetic field when it occurred. Huntington, Long Island, I was in Farmingdale, Long Island with that 12-foot dish. I was listening to the 2.3 gigahertz signal that contained astronaut audio. And I was listening to the Apollo 15 and 16 astronauts at a time they were not connected to the networks. So from time to time I heard some rather candid information because they, let me drop this, they thought they had their a very private, high-technology microwave radio signal between them and the Earth. When I sent my first letter to NASA asking for the details of the transmitting frequencies, power outputs, and antenna gains, and whatever, I could tell by the response I got, they said, for academic reasons, we're giving you information. Your chances of success compared to using a 240-foot Goldstone dish in the Mojave Desert of California, the chances of, with your tiny little antenna in Farmingdale, receiving astronaut audio, they didn't say it, but I could tell by the nature of the answer, they thought we could never do it. Well, during the time the astronauts are using the high-gain antenna, not the omnidirectional antenna, they were getting beautiful signals from them. Well, $40 antenna that consisted of aluminum spokes bent into a parabolic shape with fishing string and a feed horn that was made out of a Scottish oatmeal can and an American paint can. By the way, I just happened to have connected to that feed horn state-of-the-art low-noise parametric amplifier made by Airborne Instruments Laboratory, the company I was working for at the time. I borrowed that from Mr. Matt Labenbaum, who ran the Applied Electronics Department. And I think at the time that preamplifier was worth about $5,000. So this $40 antenna with this $5,000 parametric amplifier connected to it, that in turn went to a spectrum analyzer as a receiver, allowed me to listen to astronaut audio. A pretty wild combination, as you can tell. A very fun project. And go to that article